Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A bizarre bet that knows no bounds.
All of his friends were sitting around thinking, this is crazy. There's no way.
A frontier father's frantic hunt.
He saw no sign of anybody. They were gone.
And a reviled figure that returns from the grave.
They decided he ought to be put back in the earth, and so they buried him.
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics, tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum. Los Angeles, California. This sprawling metropolis was once the top agricultural producer in the country. As recently as 1950, LA County grew enough fruits and vegetables to feed its entire urban population. And located on a former citrus farm is the Hollywood Heritage Museum. The facility showcases rare items from the history of the silver screen, including a prop from the film The Ten Commandments, a 1912 Edison kinetoscope, and the recreated office of legendary director Cecil B. DeMille. But there is one object here that seems to have little to do with the movies.
It's nearly a century old. It's oblong in shape. It's made of rough-hewn wood bound together by metal hinges.
According to historian Steve Vaught, this wooden chest speaks to a drama that set an ordinary man against the titans of Tinseltown.
This was a true-life tale. It played out like a classic Hollywood thriller.
To whom did this trunk once belong? And what notorious Hollywood turf war did it witness? 1959, Los Angeles. For years, Hollywood's elite have dreamed of honoring their world-famous industry with a museum. And it seems that their vision is finally about to be realized. A group of powerful movie executives are in talks with LA County to establish the Hollywood Motion Picture and Television Museum.
It wasn't just going to be about movies, it was going to be about television, and it was going to include radio and the recording industry all at once under one roof.
The ambitious project has the support of everyone from Walt Disney to Lana Turner. But what it needs most is a proper location. And soon, the museum planners find a site befitting their venture, across from the celebrated Hollywood Bowl.
The press loved it, the public loved it, but there was one person who didn't, and he had a very good reason not to. His name was Steve Anthony.
Steve Anthony is an ex-Marine, bartender, and father of three. His house stands on the site of the future Hollywood Museum. In fact, if the institution is to be built, more than a dozen homes must be demolished.
The museum planners came and offered all of the residents the current market value of the homes. Surprisingly, people who had lived here for decades happily accepted this offer.
Anthony is offered $11,000 for his cottage. When he turns down the bid, the county serves him with eviction papers.
Because this was a civic project, it was considered legal to do. The county had no idea what to expect when they tried to evict Steve Anthony. He refused the eviction notices, and he hired an attorney.
In the following months, Anthony's attorneys fight the case in court.
They threw everything they could to see if anything would stick.
However, the suit is shot down. and Anthony's house is slated for demolition. But even though he's lost the legal battle, it's a different matter altogether in the court of public opinion.
He became something of a folk hero. Here he was, this ex-Marine defending his home against the overreach of big government. He had this wonderful, young, attractive family. They were camera-friendly, if you will.
On February 8, 1964, with news cameras rolling, sheriff's deputies set out to evict the Anthony family by force. The cops slowly approach the door, but what happens next catches them completely off guard.
They saw an upstairs window open, and then out pops Steve Anthony with a shotgun.
And that's not all Anthony is holding.
He had his small baby with him.
What began as a routine eviction for the county has turned into a public relations disaster.
Higher-ups finally said, let's just drop this for the day.
For the moment, Steve Anthony has thwarted his enemies. But his desperate fight to save his home isn't over.
He boarded up the windows and sent the kids away. And then he started loading up on more ammunition. As an ex-Marine, Steve Anthony knew full well that the county was coming. He just didn't know when or how.
On the night of April 13th, Anthony hears a sharp knock on the door. The visitors identify themselves as sympathetic fellow Marines, so Anthony invites them in without a second thought. But it seems he's made a terrible mistake.
All of a sudden, one of the men stood in front of him, held out a pair of handcuffs, and said, "Ever seen a pair of these?"
The visitors are actually police officers in disguise.
Steve Anthony had fallen for the Trojan horse tactic.
The officers haul Anthony out of his home and book him on charges of resisting arrest. After a night in jail, he is freed on bail. And when he returns to his property, he finds his long fight is finally over.
Steve Anthony had managed to get out of jail just in time to see his beautiful home torn down.
While he spent the night in jail, the county had removed all of his possessions. Among them, a wooden trunk, the same one now on display at the Hollywood Heritage Museum.
He wound up pretty much losing everything he had.
In the aftermath, Anthony relocates his family to Sonora, California, where he reinvents himself as a successful home builder. In a final twist of fate, it turns out that the house that Steve Anthony fought so hard to save had been demolished for nothing.
The real irony behind all of this is that no museum was actually built on this property.
Undone by mismanagement, the Hollywood Motion Picture and Television Museum is eventually canceled, and the empty site becomes a parking lot. But in 1985, a much smaller institution finally materializes on the embattled plot of land with the establishment of the Hollywood Heritage Museum. Today, Steve Anthony's trunk rests in its collection as a reminder of a gripping, real-life battle that rivaled anything seen on the silver screen. Frankfort, Kentucky. During the Civil War, this city was the sole Union capital to be occupied by Confederate troops. Today, the region's past is brought to life at the Thomas D. Clark Center for Kentucky History. Its collection includes a Ford Model T, an assortment of pioneer tools, and a pocket watch from one of the state's most famous native sons, Abraham Lincoln. And among these artifacts is the prized possession of another larger-than-life Kentuckian.
It's about 5.5 feet long. Part of it is maple, the other part is iron. And then it also has a carving in that says Boone's best friend.
According to curator Trevor Jones, the man who brandished this weapon was known for his courage, marksmanship, and pioneering spirit. But those attributes were pushed to the limit during an extraordinary episode that inspired a classic American tale.
This rifle is a symbol of one man's heroic quest to find his daughter.
What harrowing event tested the will of the legendary Daniel Boone? July 1776, the Kentucky Territory. The 13 colonies have just declared independence from Great Britain. Yet the United States already boasts a distinctly American celebrity, rugged outdoorsman Daniel Boone.
Daniel Boone is a master woodsman, a trapper, and a hunter. And he was really at the height of his powers in 1776. And there's stories of Boone killing 50 bear in a day.
And now he's blazing a new trail into the most remote frontier yet, the Kentucky wilderness. That summer, Boone, his family, and a small group of friends found a settlement along the banks of the Kentucky River. And true to Boone's already legendary reputation, the encampment is given a rather appropriate name.
They named it Boonesboro after him.
The new arrivals are eager to begin their life on the frontier, but the area's native inhabitants aren't exactly keen to welcome them.
The Shawnee and the Cherokee had been hunting these grounds for thousands of years, and both are really upset by the white settlers there. There are Indians all around Boonesboro who are occasionally stealing livestock, attacking settlers in isolated places. It was definitely not safe for white settlers in 1776.
In the face of this constant threat, Boone repeatedly warns his family and others not to wander far from the camp. But he is about to learn that words aren't enough to keep everyone safe. On a hot Sunday in July, Boone is awoken from an afternoon nap by the sound of girls crying out for help. To his horror, he immediately recognizes the voices.
It is his daughter Jemima and two other girls.
Boone picks up his rifle, just like this one, bearing his initials at Frankfort's Clark Center for Kentucky History. And he and a companion race toward the source of the screams. But by the time Boone reaches the woods, he's too late.
He saw no sign of anybody. They were gone.
Boone realizes that Jemima and her friends have been kidnapped, and tracking them down may be next to impossible.
The kidnappers already had a decent start on him, and it was going to be hard to catch up with them.
Suddenly, Boone spots something disturbing, a fragment of cloth that he recognizes as a piece of his daughter's dress.
And he's thinking, has Jemima been killed?
Boone combs the woods, frantically searching for any sign of his beloved daughter. Then he finds another shred of Jemima's clothing. A moment later, he spots a third. And suddenly, it hits him. His daughter has dropped them deliberately and is leaving a trail. Boone treks through the forest in pursuit. Hour after hour, he pushes deeper into the woods. Yet no matter how fast he moves, he can't seem to catch up.
He's worried the Indians are getting away and that he'll never see his daughter again.
Can this expert outdoorsman save the girls before it's too late?
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's July 1776 in the Kentucky wilderness.
Legendary frontiersman Daniel Boone is on a desperate quest to find his 13-year-old daughter who's been kidnapped by Native Americans. Boone is an expert hunter, but can he track down his little girl before it's too late?
Boone keeps up the chase through the Kentucky wilderness for two long days. Finally, he spies a campsite. And there, to his relief, he sees Jemima and her friends. But he also sees their captors, a small group of Shawnee and Cherokee Indians. And that's when the legendary outdoorsman makes his move.
Boone starts to creep up to the camp. Jemima looks up at that same time, and she sees her dad, and he makes a sign to her, "Don't make any noise. Don't let them know."
In a flash, Boone charges into the camp.
The Indians are taken completely by surprise. They don't have their weapons close to them. They're totally not ready to defend themselves. They all rush off into the woods.
The three girls are safe and unharmed, all thanks to the quick thinking of Daniel Boone and his resourceful daughter. Boone and his family remain in Kentucky for the next decade until the pull of the frontier lures him further west to Missouri, where he dies in 1820 at the age of 85. Daniel Boone's heroic efforts to save his daughter become an integral part of his legendary legacy. And in 1826, the tale of Jemima Boone's nerve-wracking rescue is fictionalized in James Fenimore Cooper's classic novel, The Last of the Mohicans. Today, this personalized rifle at the Clark Center for Kentucky History remains a testament to Daniel Boone, an iconic American, a rugged outdoorsman, and a fearless father. Located 70 miles south of Denver, the city of Manitou Springs, Colorado, is dotted by an unusual array of naturally occurring carbonated springs, earning it the nickname the Saratoga of the West. And this small city's unique history is celebrated here at the Manitou Springs Heritage Center. On display are 200-year-old glass water bottles, vintage poker chips, and a 1981 Donner race car. But among this assorted collection of objects is one that seems more like a leftover snack.
The artifact is about an inch long, is gray and brown in color. It would have been good tasting at one point in time, but we probably wouldn't want to eat it now.
According to museum volunteer David Walker, this tiny legume was part of a unique phenomenon that swept America.
This artifact represented a really crazy stunt and a man who was very determined to get himself in the paper.
What role did a peanut play in one of the 20th century's most unusual fads? 1928. This carefree decade is already known as the Roaring Twenties. But legions of American adventurers and thrill seekers in pursuit of a place in the record books have earned it another distinctive nickname.
This time was actually known as the Age of Wonderful Nonsense. People were really looking to do crazy, wacky things, including barnstorming, long dance hall marathons, and sitting on top of flagpoles for days at a time.
One man caught up in the era's wild spirit is a tradesman from Rio Hondo, Texas, named Bill Williams. After losing a bet over the result of the 1928 presidential election, Williams embarks on an unusual journey, pushing a peanut 11 miles with his nose.
So he went out, found his peanut, and started pushing his peanut into the next town down the road, crawling the entire way.
Amazingly, Williams succeeds and becomes a local celebrity in the process.
There were several local newspapers that picked up Bill's story of pushing the peanut. It was something that people really hadn't seen before.
This small sniff of fame has Williams hungry for more, so he announces that he will put his peanut-pushing skills to the ultimate test.
Bill decided to push his peanut up the 14,400-foot Pikes Peak.
Hiking up the famed Colorado Mountain would be challenging enough, but Bill's idea to do it while rolling a peanut with his nose seems downright impossible.
All of his friends were sitting around thinking, "This is crazy. There's no way."
Williams' friends wager $500 that he won't be able to nudge the nut all the way to the summit. And to hedge their bet, they add a seemingly impossible deadline.
Then they were only going to give him 22 days. That's 1 mile a day, 22-mile trek.
In May 1929, Williams arrives in Colorado Springs, Colorado. There, he tells a crowd of curious reporters that he's ready for anything, from the physical demands the trek will take on his body to the punishment the terrain will take on his peanut.
Bill brought several pairs of gloves with him and some special knee pads, along with a large bag of peanuts.
But his most unusual piece of equipment is a bizarre-looking face mask.
It actually was able to keep the peanut a little bit ahead of him, so he didn't have to worry about his back being pushed down and keeping his face into the dirt all the time.
Finally, Williams gets down on all fours and begins his ascent. The first part of the journey goes smoothly, and he averages over a mile a day.
Bill was on a very good pace at this point. He would push until he couldn't push anymore every day and sleep at that point, resting with his peanut.
Along the way, Williams faces a rather unique challenge. Hungry squirrels try to nab his peanut. Still, he pushes forward. But even with the pads and gloves, his knees and hands grow increasingly sore from the rough terrain.
It becomes very steep and much more dirty, rocky, and treacherous to crawl up.
Then he's suddenly hit with his biggest problem yet. The skies above Pike's Peak open up, enveloping the mountain in a violent storm. The deluge becomes so heavy that Williams is forced to wait it out.
The clock was ticking. The more the rain came, the less time he had to get to the top.
After two stormy days, the skies clear. The delay has cost Williams valuable time. But still, the peanut pusher soldiers on.
Bill was even more determined to get out there and make it to the top of the mountain.
But as he edges closer to the summit, he's hit with even worse conditions.
At the top of the peak, there was snow and ice that he was going to have to crawl through at that point.
Despite the challenge, Williams makes his final push. And at 11:30 a.m. on June 9th, he reaches the summit of Pike's Peak, hitting his 22-day cutoff by a nose.
He had gone through 150 peanuts, 12 pairs of gloves, and 3 pairs of shoes.
Williams proudly collects his $500. News of his quirky quest earns him an odd badge of honor as the first person to push a peanut up Pike's Peak with his nose.
Bill became very famous nationwide.
The publicity ignites a quirky fad as scores of imitators try to beat his record. But it's not until 1963 that a man named Ulysses Baxter, using this peanut, the same one on display at the Manitou Springs Heritage Center, smashes Williams' record by 2 weeks.
Ulysses made it up Pike's Peak in 8 days, opposed to the 22 days that Bill Williams was provided.
While peanut pushing eventually goes the way of zoot suits, pet rocks, and other 20th century fads, this humble legume remains at the Manitou Springs Heritage Center, a souvenir of an outlandish craze and a reminder of the nutty stunt that got it rolling. Elberton, Georgia is just 4 square miles in size, but is home to 45 stone quarries, a distinction that earned it its nickname, the Granite Capital of the World. And celebrating its signature industry is a unique institution, the Elberton Granite Museum. Inside, an array of artifacts, including quarry equipment, granite samples, and intricately carved headstones, pay tribute to the beautiful rock for which this community is famous. But one curious-looking item here was originally considered a disgrace.
It is approximately 7 feet in length and weighs somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3,000 pounds.
According to Elberton Granite Association Vice President Christopher Cubis, this stone figure was once so controversial that some might have preferred if it was never seen again.
At one time, this artifact was probably the most hated figure in the whole town of Elberton.
How did this statue become a figure of scorn, embarrassment, and outrage? 1898, Elberton, Georgia. 2 decades after the Civil War, this quiet community still has strong Confederate ties. And with the memory of that conflict still fresh in the minds of many, some residents believe their town lacks something rather important.
Elberton did not have a Confederate memorial to honor its dead and its veterans.
Civic leaders decide to commission a statue that they hope will be the pride of Elberton. But rather than using traditional marble, The community wants the figure to truly reflect local heritage by being carved from the region's most common resource.
They had some of the most beautiful granite that was available, and they were starting to realize that this could potentially be the medium for the monument that they wanted.
The town hires a local sculptor named Arthur Beter to create a monument worthy of display in the central square.
This was a great honor for Beter. He was very excited to have this commission.
For months, the artist labors in a secluded shed away from the prying eyes of inquisitive residents. Finally, the wait is over. And to commemorate the unveiling of Beter's masterpiece, the citizens of Elberton gather in celebratory anticipation.
There was a great amount of fanfare. It's almost a very carnival or festival-like atmosphere.
But when the statue is revealed, it isn't exactly what people expected.
Upon closer inspection, it seems to be somewhat squat, and it has almost a cartoonish type figure. The head portion seems to be very bulbous. The eyes are pronounced and very bug-eyed. It didn't look like one of the Confederate veterans that they had ever seen.
But one characteristic overshadows the rest. The statue's hat, coat, and other details make him look like he's wearing a Northern uniform.
He looked like a Union soldier.
Residents are horrified.
The last thing this southern town wanted was a Yankee watching over them.
In the days following the unveiling, the horror turns to outrage. Beter is accused of supporting the Union and run out of town. But the damage is done. Stuck with a 3,000-pound eyesore, residents mock the statue mercilessly in the local paper.
People comment that it looks like a cross between a hippopotamus and a Pennsylvania Dutchman. Ultimately, that name sticks, and that name becomes Dutchie.
For 2 years, Dutchie remains an unwelcome tenant in the town square. But on August 14, 1900, an angry group of men decide enough is enough and set out to evict the statue once and for all.
They decide that he needs to go. And so he is pulled from atop his perch. And as he tipped over, he fell to the ground where his legs were completely broken off and he laid there in pieces.
The mob disposes of Dutchie in the most fitting way possible.
They decided, like the rock that he was, he ought to be put back in the earth, and so they buried him.
As news of Dutchie's demise spreads, the town is overjoyed to be rid of the colossal embarrassment. And as the decades pass, the exact details of Dutchie's short life become lost to history, and the precise location of his final resting place is largely forgotten.
Over the years, the stories of Dutchie became like an urban legend.
Elberton's prized granite deposits helped the town launch a flourishing industry, with quarries servicing orders from around the country. In 1982, Elberton Granite Association president Bill Kelly decides to create a museum to commemorate the area's signature export. And to serve as its prized centerpiece, Kelly wants none other than Dutchie.
After all, this was the very first granite statue that was ever produced here in Elberton.
But finding him is no easy task. As Kelly digs through old records, he makes a surprising discovery. It turns out that Dutchie has been right under everyone's noses all along. Weighing in at about 3,000 pounds, Dutchie was too heavy for outraged citizens to move. So they simply buried him where he fell, right in the middle of the town square. On April 19th, a team starts digging, shoveling for hours through Georgia's famously red clay. Finally, they hit something solid.
They realized that this was a big piece of granite. They had discovered Dutchie.
Dutchie is loaded onto a flatbed truck. After over 80 years in the clay, he's a red-faced mess. So instead of taking him directly to the museum, town officials reason that the long-lost statue needs a bath.
They decide that the best place to take Dutchie would be to the local car wash.
After he's hosed down, Dutchie makes a notable second impression on a new generation of Elberton residents.
Dutchie is in pristine condition. He looks as good as the day he was sculpted.
Dutchie is finally taken to the Elberton Granite Museum. Because his legs were broken on that fateful night in 1900, he is displayed lying flat on his back. Today, Dutchie is considered a quirky point of pride in this town,
a once reviled figure whose rocky history turned him into a lovable legend. Baltimore, Maryland is renowned as much for its rich history as for its quirky charm. This is where Francis Scott Key wrote the Star-Spangled Banner, and America's first post office was built. But the city also boasts one of the country's most unusual institutions, the National Museum of Dentistry. Among the eclectic items on display are 19th century toothbrushes, George Washington's dentures, and a tooth jukebox that plays old dental jingles. But deep in the archives is a seemingly more ordinary artifact.
It is 24 inches long. It's made out of cardboard that is kind of a greenish, grayish blue. And in cream-colored letters, it says the name of the product, Pepsodent.
According to curator Scott Swank, this common household product was the focus of an unprecedented advertising campaign.
It seemed like an impossible task. How do you market a product that nobody was interested in buying?
How did a bold idea convince America to brush its teeth? Chicago, Illinois, the early 1900s. Advertising executive Claude C. Hopkins is at the top of his game. His unique ability to tap into consumers' desires has helped him turn ordinary products into runaway hits.
Claude Hopkins understood human intuition at a time before it had been scientifically studied. He knew what drove people to want a product.
One day, Hopkins is approached by an old associate who is in desperate need of his expertise. The executive explains that his company is planning to introduce a promising new toothpaste. It's called Pepsodent.
At the turn of the century, you've got all kinds of things on the market to clean your teeth. You had toothpastes, you had tooth powders, all different kinds of formulations. Pepsodent was formulated to be minty toothpaste that left your mouth with a tingling sensation once you were finished.
The makers of Pepsodent are confident it could be a big hit, but selling toothpaste presents an unusual challenge.
People didn't really see the need for it. People don't expect to keep their teeth. They're resigned to the idea that they're eventually going to have to wear dentures at some point in their life.
Not only that, but in the early 1900s, Americans are enjoying new, sugary products like never before. And that, combined with blasé attitudes about oral hygiene, is creating a huge problem.
Dentists are noticing at that time just rampant decay, and they're extracting a lot of teeth.
The crisis is so bad that with World War I looming, thousands of recruits are turned away because of their rotting teeth, causing Army officials to declare that poor dental health has become a national security risk.
It became a real problem for them in terms of having enough what they would consider able-bodied men to serve.
Yet despite this epidemic, very few in the country seem motivated to prevent tooth decay.
Up to this point, toothpaste had attempted marketing campaigns, either through technical aspects of the toothpaste or they went the route of scare tactics. The campaigns didn't work.
In fact, only 7% of Americans bother to use toothpaste at all. Trying to get anyone excited about taking care of their teeth seems like a losing proposition. But Hopkins is up for the challenge.
Hopkins knew it was a hard sell, but he felt that maybe I really can make this work.
In search of inspiration, Hopkins delves into stacks of dental textbooks. Little in the dry technical prose seems to stoke the fires of inspiration. But then, as Hopkins pores over a dental journal, something catches his eye.
That was the key he needed to get people interested in his product.
Hopkins reads about an unsightly bacterial coating that can stain teeth and cause decay. It's called mucin plaque.
We would know it today simply as plaque, that film that covers your teeth.
Hopkins believes that by focusing on this coating, he can finally break through public resistance to toothbrushing. The ad man renames mucin plaque the film. He then creates a marketing campaign that focuses not on oral health, but on keeping up appearances.
Got to keep this yellow film off your teeth regularly to keep yourself attractive. He really wasn't selling toothpaste, he was selling beauty.
Hopkins places ads warning Americans about this unsightly film in publications across the country.
prompting people everywhere to suddenly become obsessed with getting rid of it.
The plaque made your teeth yellow. You use the toothpaste and you get rid of the yellow.
And soon, brushing with Pepsodent becomes a part of Americans' daily routine.
He was trying to create a habit so people would come back and use the product over and over again.
Within just one decade of the product's launch, Pepsodent toothpaste can be found in 65% of households in the United States. Dental care soon explodes into a multi-billion dollar industry. Over time, drugstore shelves become lined with toothpaste brands and flavors to suit every taste and preference. And while few may recall that it took a clever advertising campaign to get Americans to brush their teeth, 100 years after his stroke of inspiration, Claude Hopkins' brilliant marketing tactics are held up in business schools and boardrooms as case studies of how to create demand for products no one thinks they need.
They still use examples of Hopkins' advertising campaigns, with Pepsodent being one of them.
Today, this Pepsodent container is preserved at the National Museum of Dentistry in Baltimore. It's a symbol of a marketing mastermind who convinced Americans to take good care of their pearly whites, creating a daily habit. Dublin, the capital of Ireland, was founded in the 9th century by Vikings, who ruled over the city for nearly 300 years. Today, relics from the country's storied heritage are preserved here at the National Museum of Ireland. Its collection includes a carved head from the Iron Age, a cross from the Middle Ages, and an assortment of Nordic weapons. But even among these ancient treasures, one shimmering artifact stands out.
It is incredibly detailed. It is just under 8 inches in length, about 3 inches wide. It's made from solid gold.
According to curator Andy Halpin, this object's small size belies its monumental significance and the epic fight that erupted when it was found.
This is one of the most important archaeological discoveries in the history of Ireland.
What role did this boat play in a bitter dispute between two traditional rivals? 1896, Broider, County Derry, Ireland. Two farmhands are tilling a field when they hit something hard in the dirt.
The two men had a good look, and eventually they found several discolored metal objects. They probably didn't look terribly impressive.
The men bring the items to their employer. And the farmer, suspecting they might be more than just junk, sells them to an antiquities dealer named Robert Day. And when Day has the objects restored, they reveal a shimmering array of treasures.
There is a wonderful gold collar, two other necklaces, and a miniature cauldron.
But perhaps the most striking object is a gold boat.
It is complete in every detail, including the mast for sailing and the oars for rowing.
In 1897, an archaeological journal publishes a story about the find, now called the Broider Hoard. The paper says the artifacts are Celtic in origin and date from the 1st century BC.
It's at this point that the discovery of the hoard becomes public knowledge, and that's when things start getting really exciting.
The Broider Hoard soon finds a new home, not in Ireland, but at the British Museum.
Robert Day sold the hoard to the British Museum in London for the sum of £600, which is a lot of money, in 1897.
The revelation outrages the people of Ireland, who, after nearly a century of British rule, are beginning to reassert their homeland's distinct political and cultural identity.
Nationalist feeling in Ireland is growing, and they saw this as, this hoard is ours, and these English people have no right to it. It belongs in Ireland.
The scandal prompts Ireland's premier scientific and cultural institution, the Royal Irish Academy, to intervene.
The Royal Irish Academy approached the British Museum and asked them to hand them over.
But officials with the British Museum refuse. And in 1903, after years of public squabbling, both sides get a chance to present their case in London's High Court. The fate of the Broider Hoard rests on an obscure theory.
The case came down to a battle over the interpretation of this archaic notion of treasure trove.
If the hoard was hidden with the intent of it being dug up one day, it's considered buried treasure that rightfully belongs to Ireland. If it was lost or discarded and never intended to be found, it belongs to whomever discovered the item's true provenance, and that would keep the hoard in London.
They argued that the site at Bruyter 2,000 years ago was probably underwater, and that the hoard was dropped into the water as an offering to a god.
According to the British Museum, the ceremonial items were never meant to be seen again, other than by a Celtic deity. And as such, the discovery and eventual transfer of the hoard to the British Museum does not qualify as treasure trove.
The argument that the British Museum put forward is that their purchase of the hoard was legally valid and could not be contested.
To counter the British Museum's argument, barristers call on a scientist named Robert Lloyd Prager.
Prager was a man of many talents. He was a geologist, he was a naturalist, he was also an antiquarian.
Prager explains that to prepare for the case, he went to the field in Bruyter and inspected the area himself. And there, very close to the location where the hoard was discovered, he unearthed a perfectly preserved Neolithic site. Considered the last era of the Stone Age, the Neolithic period ended between 4,500 and 2,000 BC, thousands of years before the items in the Bruyter hoard would have been crafted. Prager argues that the site he examined was so well preserved that it could not have been spoiled by the sea, a fact that seems to undermine the British Museum's case.
The idea of the hoard being deposited as an offering to a sea god suddenly began to look very flimsy.
Finally, as both sides rest, the judge issues his ruling.
Ultimately, he ruled that the hoard should return to Ireland. He dismissed the British Museum's argument. He wasn't even convinced that there was any evidence for a Celtic sea god.
For the Irish people, the victory is especially sweet.
Ireland has had many battles with England over the centuries, and we haven't won many of them, but this was one that we won.
Eventually, the Bruyter hoard is given a place of honour in the National Museum of Ireland.
I think we can safely say that the Bruyter hoard will be remaining in Dublin.
Today, this gold boat, once part of an infamous archaeological find, is a glimmering reminder of the fierce battle for sovereignty and a proud nation's rich history. From a Hollywood holdout to a famous frontiersman, a lost treasure to a stone-faced figure.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.